A real-life historical detective, modern-day Indiana Jones, Graham Phillips, our guest for the remainder of the show as we talk about the mystery of the Ark of the Covenant. Has it been found? Where is it? So many people have laid claim to this mysterious artifact. As a matter of fact, there was a rumor, Graham, that President George Bush believed Saddam Hussein may have had possession of the Ark at some point, and that might in fact have been the weapon of mass destruction he was referring to and why he became obsessed with going to Iraq. Is that one of the legends you've heard as well?
I haven't really looked into that one. I've sort of carried my research into the Middle Ages when the Templars claimed to have found it. But I think what that does show is just, you know, the very fact that that rumor, maybe it's completely false, made that rumor that it should have spread so far and wide and got so much interest shows how fascinated people are in the Ark of the Covenant and the fact that the story is that it's supposed to have the ability to destroy entire armies is, well, pretty much unique. It's a unique legend, if you like, attached to that particular item. I don't know of anything else that is said to have this power.
Can you tell me, and then we have to go to a break here real quickly, what was the first aha moment you had that you realized you might be on the right path for this legend of the Ark?
Well, if you remember, I said that there was an Arab chronicler who mentioned that the Knights Templars in Petra in southern Jordan claimed to have found the Ark in the late 1100s. It was the fact that I managed to trace who these Templars were and where they came from, which incidentally was in central England, which is where I'm from, at a place very close to Stratford-upon-Avon, where Shakespeare was born. And it's when I actually discovered from the writings of that area at that time, the records said that these Knights Templars had in their possession a large golden box that they thought was of great importance. That's the aha moment.
All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, Graham Phillips will walk us through his historical journey to find the Ark of the Covenant. A little later on in the show, we'll take some of your questions. We'll do that here. I'm Dave Schrader, and you're listening to the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM. Graham Phillips continues to be our guest for the remainder of the show. I'll be back hosting Coast to Coast on New Year's Eve. I'm looking forward to being back with you all at that time. Not sure what we're going to cover yet. I don't know if George wants me to take over the prediction show at that point, but I'm open to suggestions in case he wants to cover that on the first. So if you have any great ideas and something that you'd like to hear covered on Coast to Coast that maybe has not been covered or a different aspect of one of these stories, I always encourage you to reach out to me, and you can email me Dave@darknessradio.com. That's Dave@darknessradio.com. And if you have questions for our guests, you can certainly email those over to me as well, and I'll try to work them through in the show this evening. Graham Phillips, we are discussing the Ark of the Covenant. Let's start with your journey here and where it brought to you that you believe you've actually, you know, the location of this historic relic.
Well, what I was trying to do was to find out what had happened to this golden chest or golden box that the Knights Templars at least claimed was the Ark or thought was the Ark. It certainly was apparently found by them in what I'd also completely independently worked out was the most likely place for the Ark to have been hidden at the time the Babylonians invaded in the 500s BC. So it kind of had there was a consistency to the storyline, if you see. But what had happened is that these Templars that came from a place called Temple Hardwick, which is actually named after them in central England, is that once they returned from the Crusades, they built a chapel at this Temple Hardwick location below some hills. And this chapel was said to have contained this golden chest. Now, if this was the Ark, then what happened to it? What happened to these Templars that claimed to have possessed it? Interestingly, when the other Templars throughout Europe were outlawed in the early 1300s by the Pope, they were accused of heresy, and basically the Pope and the King of France owed the Templars a lot of money, so they pretty much trumped up a series of charges. And had them all arrested and their lands and possessions confiscated. It's in fact only now, only a few weeks ago, that the Vatican has finally, what would you call it, forgiven the Knights Templars. They basically said, we were wrong to arrest the Knights Templars. We find them innocent. So they've been sort of re-communicated, so to speak. But back at, you know, in the 1300s, Templars were being arrested left, right, and centre, and their assets were being stripped. But nobody found the supposed treasure of the Knights Templars, all the wealth that they're supposed to have accumulated in the Middle East, which, of course, included the Ark of the Covenant. But interestingly, while Templars were being persecuted throughout Europe, in England, the king here had fallen out with the Pope, and so the Templars continued. And these Templars at Temple Hardwick were one of the last lot to survive, but eventually they were wiped out by the Black Death in the mid-1300s. Now, while the Black Death was sweeping Europe, people in many areas knew that their time could be up very shortly. And what the Templars of Temple Hardwick did was to hide what they had in their chapel and left a series of clues as to where it was. Now, the idea of this is, if they all got killed off by the Black Death, which, incidentally, they did, other Templars from elsewhere in the country may be able to come there, recognize a particular symbolism that the Templars would have in common, and be able to work out from this where their treasures were, and they could go and search for them. Now, this, if I am right, included, or may have simply been, the Ark of the Covenant itself. Now, this was the story that existed around Temple Hardwick for years, but people over the centuries had gone along to the Templar chapel and looked around the area and found no evidence that the Templars had ever really left any clues. One particularly famous person who tried to look to see if there was clues as to where the Ark of the Covenant might have been hidden by the Templars was Sir Walter Raleigh, the person who brought tobacco back to Europe and the potato, supposedly. He searched in vain for any clues that the Templars might have left. But what was fascinating is around about 1900, the Templars had built a separate church as well as the chapel that they kept their treasures in. And in this chapel, it was being renovated around the late 1800s, and the plaster work of the walls was removed, and behind it was found a whole series of wall murals, paintings representing all sorts of strange symbolism. And what was fascinating about this is that two of the main figures represented on these wall murals were the archangels Gabriel and Michael, one of them holding a chalice, which was supposed to be the symbol of the archangel Gabriel, the other one holding a severed head. Now, what's fascinating about this, firstly, is they must have been Templar designs and not put there by anybody else, because the severed head, worshipping a severed head, is the crime that the Templars were accused of, which got them accused of blasphemy in the first place. So it's a Templar symbolism. I won't bother going into what it means, but it didn't actually mean worshipping a real head. But the important point is that the archangels, Gabriel and Michael, were the two angels represented on top of the Ark of the Covenant, according to ancient Jewish tradition. So it did seem to a lot of historians who lived in the central part of England that what had been discovered in this church were the very clues that the Knights Templars had left in the mid-1300s to the whereabouts of treasures, including the Ark of the Covenant.
Now, you've got this imagery that's been hidden for centuries that is suddenly unveiled. How do they make the leap that this artwork must be detailing a map of some sorts? I mean, couldn't it just be that this was just representations of things that were important to them and had nothing to do with literal treasure?
Absolutely. Now, one particular guy who decided that, well, let's have a look into this and find out if these are maps, if you like, or clues to lead to something, was a local historian called Jacob Cove Jones. Now, he looked into this and decided that he was convinced that these were a set of clues leading to somewhere, and he believed he'd found out where they led to. Now, at the same time, he found that he was dying, he didn't have long to live, and decided not to actually inform anybody of what he had discovered. Now, why he did this, why he didn't tell anybody, is, you know, open to debate. His family believe it was because other archaeologists and historians didn't believe one word he was saying about these Templars' treasures. They said that, if these were clues, the Templars never found anything anyway. And he said, well, they may have brought things back which were treasures, even if they weren't treasures that belonged to that had nothing to do with the Old Testament. And others then said, well, we don't think there's any clues in these paintings at all. And he said there was. And because they fell out and he didn't have long to live, he decided he wasn't going to tell anybody. Now, this is where it gets really interesting. He rightfully deduced that it was not going to be long before these freshly exposed paintings on the wall were going to crumble, because they didn't have back then in the early 1900s the way of preserving these things once they'd been uncovered, and they very quickly crumbled away. In fact, today you can hardly make out anything of these murals. You can still see the angels Michael and Gabriel and a few other bits and pieces. So we don't really know what it was that got Jacob Cove Jones to decide that this really was a series of clues, and we have no idea where they led. But because he foresaw this happening, because he could see that these things were crumbling away, he apparently claimed to have put together his own series of clues, a new set of clues that he created in 1906, which was in the form of a stained glass window that he had commissioned and made according to his instructions and installed in a tiny little church in a place called Langley, near where he lived. The church was just being built at that time. And so he donated this window to the church and said, you know, please put it in. And according to his family, and according to his own writings, he actually left a series of clues in this window to reveal where he believed that the original clues had led to the whereabouts of the Ark. So it was getting complicated, but more exciting by the day.
Now, when you go to look at this, and I've watched your video, you go there, not sure what to expect, but to find this mural stained glass window that supposedly has these so important clues, and instead of anything that kind of shows the Ark itself or any part of that, it's kind of astounding, because what you stumble upon is more of the story of the three wise men.
Yeah.
And was that a bit of a surprise to you?
The first surprise was quite how small this window was. I mean, the church that it's in is the smallest, one of the smallest in England. The window, it's a stained glass window, but it's only about 4 feet high and about 2 or 3 feet wide. So it's only a tiny window, but it's crammed full of weird symbolism. But the central images are the Virgin Mary and the baby Jesus and the three wise men with their gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And it's called the Nativity window because it shows the Nativity scene. Now, I was thinking when I first went to see this that it was going to show the Ark of the Covenant. It didn't. And at first, this had me completely stumped. I had no idea why it should be shown in a Nativity scene. I mean, I kind of even began to think, well, the stories of the fact that he had left these clues here were just, you know, it isn't true. It doesn't tie up with the Ark at all. But I thought, okay, if it does, what could he be telling us? You know, how could this window, this imagery, lead to something? Well, I thought, okay, let's just take a bit of a leap of faith and say that there is clues. What the story of the three wise men visiting the baby Jesus is that they found him by following a star. And there's actually a star represented at the top of this window. And I thought, okay, maybe, just possibly, a star is what Jacob Cove Jones is trying to tell us, that a star will lead us to the baby Jesus. But which one? It will lead us to the Ark in this case, like the star led the three wise men to the baby Jesus. But then I looked at it a bit more closely, and I realized that the image of the star actually represented two stars, one superimposed on the other. And this is where I thought there is possibly something here, because two stars are associated with the Ark of the Covenant. Remember I said that the two angels on top are in ancient tradition supposed to be the archangels Gabriel and Michael?
Right.
Well, they are represented in the heavens in Jewish tradition as two tail stars of what we call now the Big Dipper or the Great Bear. And the two tail stars are called Benetnash and Mizar. Now, in the stained glass window right next to this star double star design were the initials, the letters M and B, Benetesh, Mizar. So I thought, hold on, maybe those two tail stars are to lead to the location of the ark, maybe at a certain time of the year and from a certain place. If you observe these stars, they will somehow give you a reference, a sighting line on the horizon or something. Now, right between these letters B and M that may stand for Benetesh and Mizar, and right next to this double star design was the image of a phoenix rising, the firebird rising from the flames, which was an unusual thing to have in a window of Jesus. And I thought, hold on, I'd heard that phoenix somewhere locally before. In fact, the local hills are called the Phoenix Hills. And I thought, ah, wait a minute, maybe it's giving us some indication about that. But the dead center image of the whole window, which you can see on my website, which again, graeme-phillips.net, you can have a look at it and see this window for yourself. The dead central image is one of the items, one of the gifts being held by the wise men, one of the wise men. And it's the casket that he's held, that one of the gifts is in the myrrh, I believe. But it's basically what it looks like he's holding is this castellated tower. In other words, he's holding a little model of a round tower that's got battlements on the top of it, but it's got this weird pointed roof, and it's like this sandy gold color. Incredibly, right on top of these Phoenix Hills, overlooking the Templar's Chapel, is this conical, this round tower that was actually built by the Knights Templars. It's quite big, it's about 12 feet high, but it's exactly the same as this little object that one of the wise men is holding in his hands. It's got the castellated roof, and it's got the conical shaped roof on top of that. It's the same thing. And on this picture, on this image in the window, is another representation of the phoenix bird. And this tower is called the Phoenix Tower. The Phoenix Beacon, to give you its true name. And I was convinced that what Jacob Cove Jones was telling us was that if we go to the Phoenix Beacon and observe the two tail stars of what we now call the plough, it would lead us to where he believed, at least, the Ark was hidden.
You start to see this story unfold in front of you, from this obscure reference of the nativity scene to suddenly realizing, wow, there's something to this, and then realizing that it's actually aligning. You've stumbled into your own Da Vinci Code. Dan Brown couldn't have written it this well. How exciting is that for you, Graham, when that realization hits?
Well, I mean, this all began before the Da Vinci Code. You know, the Da Vinci Code wasn't written at this point when I first was finding all this out. And
right.
As far as I knew, I was the first person to actually be following clues like this. And I was absolutely, I don't know, I was, all I can just say is that I was extremely excited. But the problem was, I suddenly realized that, okay, I might know where to go, and I might know what to look for, but when should I actually be going and looking at these two stars?
Well, we're gonna take a break. We'll find out that part of the mystery when we return. We'll also start taking your calls if you'd like to be a part of the show. Then we encourage you to pick up your phone and dial. We've got more Graham Phillips, more Raiders of the Lost Ark. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Thank you all for joining me this evening as we look into the historical mysteries of the Bible and some of the amazing items that have fascinated us thanks to movies and books and relics. And our guest, Graham Phillips, is here. We're going to start taking phone calls in a few minutes, Graham. Here's an interesting point from Michelle. She says, if I were dying, why wouldn't I just find the Ark and give it to authorities instead of wasting the rest of my life having a stained glass window specially created as a map in a secret pictorial code, hoping someone will figure it out someday, maybe? And that's a pretty valid point.
It's a very good point, and that's a question I ask myself. But there was two things. One, it was something of a fad in Victorian times for people who were antiquarians, kind of amateur archaeologists and historians, if you like, to kind of leave a personal epitaph if they thought they knew something and they hadn't got long to go. Rather than reveal it there and then, they would leave series of clues and hints around and hope for people to sort of... It would immortalize them as people tried to solve these clues to discover what it was that they had found out. So it, A, was something of a fad, but it didn't take him that long to actually put this together. He bequeathed his money to this church, to build this little church, to help build it, and to put the window in. And his friend, who actually had made the window, it only took him like a day to actually say, these are the items I want put in the window. So it only took him a couple of days. And he was on his deathbed. He had consumption. In other words, that's TB, and he was at the later stages of it. So he basically couldn't get out of bed. Is the answer.
Just before the break, you were giving us a bit of an insight. When do you look for this? You'd found the clues. You found what it was looking for. You found the two stars. But at what time should you seek this? And before we go to break again here and then start taking calls, Graham, what was the magic moment for you? What did you realize would be the date that would be best to seek this?
There was pictured a little red archway, and I thought a little red brick arch, and I thought, that's what I'm looking for because it's right under the stars. The question is, when should I observe these two stars? The answer was in the window itself, I eventually worked out. It was called the Epiphany window when it represents the day of Epiphany, when the wise men are supposed to have visited Jesus, which is the 12th night of Christmas, between the 5th and 6th of January. So that was the date. And at the very top of the painting, of the window, was represented a rooster crowing. And the early Christian tradition is that the wise men were eventually taken to the stable where Jesus was born when a cockerel cried aloud at midnight on top of the place that they were looking for. So the time was midnight, the day was the Epiphany day, and I went to that tower, saw the two tail stars on the horizon pointing downwards, and when you went to the location on the horizon where they pointed to, you ended up in a little village called Chapel Green, and there stood a red brick arch, just as depicted in the window.
So everything was lining up to exactly what you had uncovered through these stained glass window images.
Yes, indeed it was. And the next thing I had to do was to get a professional geophysics team in to actually examine that area properly to see what was buried where this red brick arch now stood.
And what were you able to ascertain from that? What could you find?
Well, basically, this red brick arch was beside the road, and it was actually a Victorian drinking fountain, but it had been there in Jacob Cove Jones's time, but it replaced an earlier holy well that had been there from medieval times. And the reason the area is called Chapel Green is an old chapel once stood there. Now, although the geophysics showed that the chapel had been in that area, what we then discovered was that it had been completely demolished. The ruins of the chapel had been demolished in about 70 years ago. I think it was not exactly 1947 when the work took place. They had to make way for a modern road and some modern houses in the area and modern landscape gardening. And so they completely dug up the old chapel. And although the original geophysics survey showed that there was no great big gold object hidden there, what was discovered amongst the rubble of the old chapel was a stone tablet, a broken stone tablet, with some ancient writing on it, which was eventually identified as being an early form of Hebrew, which has never been actually translated. It's called Proto-Sinaitic. But what's fascinating is that this particular stone was made from rock that is found in the Sinai wilderness, in particular in the Shire. Gara Mountains, the very area that I believe the Mountain of God, Mount Sinai, was. So there kind of was a possibility that this might have been a broken part of one of the Ten Commandment tablets that the Ark was made to contain.
You would think they would have been a little bit more cautious, especially with something that important, when they were hightailing it out of there and removing the Ark, though, don't you?
No, this is what I think happened. What we know of this original chapel that stood there in the medieval period is that it had a, underneath it, there was a vault. It was a little chapel. It was used for worship, but below it there was this vault. This, I believe, is where the Templars could have hidden the Ark, could have placed it at the time when they were, you knew that the Black Death was on its way. But this is where they left the series of clues to point to, that Jacob Cove Jones then left his own series of clues to replace the others, and that it was safely there until the 1940s, when nobody knows there's anything important in this ruined church. And back then, places weren't preserved in the way they are today. There was this ruin. Underneath it, the vault was still completely safe and secure, but the ruins were just walls. So the workmen that were involved in this, widening the road, or putting the new road in, just literally chucked all the rubble to one side, got rid of the chapel remains, but discovered that there was this vault underneath it. And I believe there's a possibility that they found this huge golden chest, the Ark, and what was inside it. I mean, these guys are not necessarily going to know all about biblical history or the temples or anything else. And so they find there's a couple of inscribed stones inside. Well, why do they want them? So they chuck them to one side, a part of one we find many years later, and they then make off with this Ark, this golden box. That is my theory.
Fascinating. We have to take a break. We'll come back with your calls next on Coast to Coast AM. We're back. Graham Phillips, our guest. And if you'd like to know where he believes the Ark ended up, please insert 395 for the next 3 minutes. No, I'm just kidding. Graham, where do you think the Ark ended up after its removal from that church in that vault?
Well, this is what has taken a long time to find out. I mean, mm-hmm. The fear was that it had been melted down and sold off by these workmen who may have found it. Or maybe it had been sold to an antiquities collector. But I needed to know who these workmen actually were that had been involved in leveling this old chapel that may have found it. And it took a long time, but eventually in the records of the county of Warwickshire, which is where it was, I discovered that the name of the guy whose company was used to do the work was one Aldwyn Porter. And I thought, right, let's find out what happened to him. You know, maybe there's some evidence that he sold this item to somebody. Well, what was fascinating is he had a building company and he was a relatively wealthy guy. But then suddenly, in the late 1940s, he was extraordinarily rich. He bought one of the largest houses in Warwickshire, the county of Warwickshire. But what was most extraordinary is that he basically stopped he gave up his building company, and he used his wealth to renovate an old, disused church and completely change the insides and reconstructed what the Bible describes, how the Bible describes the Temple of Solomon. The Temple of Solomon in ancient Israel is said to have been where the Ark of the Covenant was kept. This guy who had been digging up the area where I believe the Ark of the Covenant ended up suddenly uses his money, where he gets this from, who knows, to build a replica of the Temple of Solomon. Now, he builds this nearby, at a place called, nearby where I believe the Ark ended up, at a place called Guy's Cliff House. And then, in 1955, he basically seems to disappear from Britain for a long time until he dies many years later. He comes back dead, he comes back and dies, but he goes off around the world doing something. But while he's away, he Freemasons. And the Freemasons used this reconstructed Temple of Solomon for their meetings. Now, most Templar lodges, their halls, are representations of the Temple of Solomon to some degree, because that's their tradition, that they descend from the Masons who originally built Solomon's Temple. But this temple that this guy had made was a complete replica of it. And it still survives to this day. And I believe, that this is as far as it's taken me anyway, that at one point in the 50s, this ark was kept in this place that he used, not for Masonic rites originally, but for whatever he used it for. And then later, it falls into the hands of the Masons. Now, I've questioned a lot of these Freemasons. They don't know anything about it. But what they do say is that the symbolism that's on the wall in this chapel at Guy's Cliff House in Warwickshire is not normal Masonic symbolism. And one of the actual representations there is of the Ark of the Covenant. And that's as far as I've got at the moment. I'm sure that at some point in the 50s, the Ark was in this chapel, but it's somewhere in the area. I don't know where. And I think there might be yet more clues, remorseless clues, if you like, to take me one step further.
All right, let's grab a couple of calls. If you have questions, this is the time to share them. East of the Rockies, Richard in New York, do you have a quick question for our guest?
Well, it's a kind of complicated question. I believe okay. The Ark of the Covenant is kind of found in that when you were talking about the two golden angels and the mercy seat, those are the two halves of the human brain, and the mercy seat is the pineal gland. Now, this matches a larger Ark of the Covenant found between the Pleiades and the constellation of Orion and the central Sun of Suns. There's actually a third intermediary step in between, but the light that comes from the pineal gland is spiritualized atoms replicating themselves as the Christ aura, or in Lemurian terms, it would be the Shekinah. And that is in an intermediary step between the light of day and the darkness of night. The earth is divided into two halves. One is the day part, and the other one is called the eve part. And both of them are responsive towards the sun. And this is also found in the Great Pyramid. I'm not a Freemason, nor am I a Knights Templar person, but there are three steps within the Great Pyramid. The third step is leading to the antechamber, where that antechamber is the medulla oblongata, also the golden reed, where atoms are separated as one enters the king's chamber. And the king's chamber is not under the eye of Horus, as a lot of people suspect. It's off to the side. It's giving you a message that the king's chamber is off to the side. I could go on and on about this, but I'd like to hear your... I think this is a gift to the American public or those that are listening, that the true Ark of the Covenant is found. It's a gift from God. It's found in your head. Those
well,
are the two halves
really
of the...
about what you say about the two angels, Ark. Drawing attention to that and the mercy seat between them.
Thank you, Richard, for calling in, by the way. Go ahead, Graham.
Sorry, Beck Mathen.
I just told Richard, thank you for calling in, and go ahead,
right,
feel
yes,
free to address
okay,
it.
Absolutely. Right. The ark, as I mentioned earlier, was making arks or golden boxes to carry around sacred items, was a tradition in ancient Egypt. And whereas I said there was a similar thing to the ark in Tutankhamun's tomb that has on its lid the jackal god Anubis, is because it had inside it an inscription, or a single stone inscription, I believe, a prayer to Anubis that was considered sacred to that god. Now, on the lid of the Ark of the Covenant, there are two angels, and the Ark of the Covenant was said to house, to contain two items, the two stone tablets of the Ten Commandments. So in a sense, it's possible that the ancient Israelites believed that what was most sacred of all ark itself, but the two stone tablets that it actually contained. Now, if one of those, or part of one of those, is what we actually found at the place that the clues had led, then what is fascinating about it is that it has been photographed, but very often strange kind of distortions in the photograph come out. People have said there's something weird about this. It's actually been examined by people at Oxford University who have said that it's got a higher than normal amount of radiation than a stone of that type would actually usually have. It's not radiation bad enough to hurt anybody, but all things are to some degree radioactive. Well, most things, many things are to some degree radioactive that aren't harmful, and this is one of them, but they can't understand quite why it is so radioactive. So, in other words, it's possible that the two angels on the lid represented to some degree the two stones inside, and it was them that somehow had this power.
Very, very cool. Graham, it's always a pleasure talking to you, and you have such an amazing grasp of the history and the mysteries involved. And please, as you continue your journey on this, let us know what you find and where you're going next on this this type of thing. And I encourage people to check out your page, follow along. You've got links on your Facebook pages, on your regular pages, so that people can see your journey as you go and really get a chance to dig even deeper with the books that you've made available.
Yeah, I mean, the book originally, The Templars and the Ark of the Covenant, if you read that, you will see the search right the way up until the point where we get to where I think it was eventually hidden. And then what goes on after that, if you go onto my Facebook, Graham Phillips Author, or onto my website, GrahamPhillips.net, I'll be keeping people up to date. And this is ongoing as we speak.
Well, Graham, thank you for spending some time with us this evening, and we wish you much success in the future. I look forward to talking to you again real soon. I want to thank everybody for tuning in and spending the last two nights with me here, and special thanks go back to the head office, Nathan, and Gina Salvati for running the show for us this evening, my engineer and best buddy here, Tim Dennis in Minnesota, producers Amy Rouse, Chris Boros, and, of course, Lisa Lyon and George Norrie for allowing me to sit in. David Elkington, our guest in the first 2 hours, Graham Phillips here in the end of the show. It's been a pleasure speaking with you all. Be nice, be kind, love one another, have a great holiday season. I wish it is filled with much love and laughter for all of you listening. And I'll be back with you on New Year's Eve. I'm Dave Schrader at darknessradio.com, and you've been listening to Coast to Coast AM.